Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We often romanticize it, but what was it really like growing up in small-town America in the first half of the 20th century? That's the subject of a new book by Dorothy Hubbard Schweider, who is Jim Madison's guest this week. And Sean Marie Garrett will also be joining us with a commentary she has titled The Return of the Repressed on the Revival of Minstrelsy. But before we hear from them, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on February 12, 1793, Congress enacted the first Fugitive Slave Act. It allowed slave owners and slave catchers to capture slaves that had escaped into other states and to force them back into slavery. The implications of the act ran deep in the divide between North and South. Many white abolitionists in the North joined with free blacks to fight slave catchers. Northern states refused to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act, fomenting angry reaction in the South. So a second Fugitive Act was passed in 1850. That law required the return of runaway slaves, quote, on pain of heavy penalty. It allowed slaves the right to trial by jury, but they could not testify in their own defense. Finally, in 1857, in the Dred Scott case, the United States Supreme Court ruled that African Americans, free or slave, could not be citizens of the United States, and therefore had no legal rights at all. They were, in fact, considered property, and could not be taken from their owners without due process of law.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, economic disparities between the descendants of former slaves and free blacks largely disappeared within just two generations following emancipation, according to a study by a Dartmouth College economist. And that may lend ammunition to opponents of slave reparations, on which we reported in earlier shows. There's nothing positive you can say about slavery, Bruce Sacerdote said, but what the study shows is how little slavery has to do with today's problems. His study, titled Slavery and the Intergenerational Transmission of Human Capital, is the first of its kind to specifically measure the status of the children and grandchildren of former slaves as compared to the descendants of free blacks. It compares data from the 1880 and 1920 censuses, concentrating on the outcome measures of literacy, school attendance, whether a child lives in a female-headed household, and measures of adult occupation. Among the study's findings is that children of former slaves were less likely to be enrolled in school than the children of blacks born free, but that this gap disappeared when examining the grandchildren of free blacks and former slaves. Other social factors, Sacerdote concludes, must account for current social inequalities between African Americans and whites. This is Talking History. Small-town America is the stuff of American memory, myth, and legend, but it's also part of our history, our real history, and that is the subject of Jim Madison's conversation this week with Dorothy Hubbard Schweider.
We have today a story of growing up, coming of age in a very different part of America, the America of the Northern Great Plains in the first half of the 20th century. Our guest is Dorothy Hubbard Schweider, who is Professor Emeritus of History at Iowa State University, and the author of a combination of memoir and history titled Growing Up with the Town, Family and Community on the Great Plains, published recently by the University of Iowa Press. Welcome, Dorothy.
Well, thank you.
Let's begin with the physical environment of the place in which you grew up, the Northern Great Plains, or as you call it, the West River region. What kind of place was it?
Well, it was a harsh place to live. You know, at the time we're all growing up, we don't have much of a perspective. But it's a part of the country where it has limited rainfall. 16 to 18 inches per year in the county where I grew up. Very few trees except along rivers and streams. It's not exactly flat, just sort of gently undulating, but really not too many hills. And without trees and with little water, it was just a really difficult experience for the early people. I might add one additional thing today, because so many farms and ranches today are really, they're so sparse now. The distance between farmsteads and the distance between major towns is also quite an issue.
Yes. Now, for our listeners, on a mental map, we're in the state of South Dakota, and we're in the western part, not too far from Mount Rushmore. How far from Mount Rushmore is the town you grew up in?
It's roughly about 180 miles.
Yes.
Yeah, and the easiest way to think about West River, South Dakota, the Missouri pretty much, not quite, but pretty much divides South Dakota in half. And for South Dakotans, it was always, are you East River or West River?
And you're West River.
I'm West River.
Mm-hmm. You use the adjective a couple of times, unforgiving. This is an unforgiving place. What do you mean by that?
Well, it was just a very harsh land. One of the things that always sticks in my mind, it was something I heard growing up, it was kind of a five-year cycle. If farmers in the area could get good crops 2 years out of five, if they had sufficient rainfall 2 years out of five, they could survive. The other 3 years could be drought years, and the farmers would make it.
Right.
And I think that underscores the point that it was not extensive or intensive agriculture like in Iowa and the prairie states, but it was really extensive agriculture.
Yes, but you didn't grow up on a farm, even though you know farming, I suppose, but you grew up in a town. Tell us about this town.
That's right. And, you know, people sometimes assume that if you lived in a small town, Pressure had about 500 when I was growing up, that it's the same thing as living on a farm. But it isn't. It's very, very different. Pressure, when I was growing up, had a really wide assortment of stores. We had our own school, of course, grades 1 through 12. In fact, Pressure really was quite a stopping over place for people traveling to the Black Hills. And so it really had, when I was growing up, quite a dynamic economy, even though it was only 500 people.
And the roads were not paved? The streets were not paved?
Precious Main Street was not paved. And I remember even as a little girl being told in a rain you didn't walk out on the road because you got stuck and you stood there till your dad or somebody else came and lifted you up and took you back to the sidewalk.
Yes. And yet you had a movie theater.
We did have a movie theater, mm-hmm. And Pressure also had a swimming pool. It was quite unusual. It might have been the only small town in the entire stretch from Sioux Falls to South to Rapid City, which covers the whole state, the only small town that had a swimming pool, and it came mainly because of the WPA.
Right. And we are talking about the 1930s and 40s as you're a child in Pressure, South Dakota. You're a child... a younger member of a very large family. Tell us about the Hubbard family.
Well, the Hubbard family was interesting. It was really, I suppose, in today's vernacular, it was a blended family. My dad's first wife, he and his first wife had seven children. And when that seventh child was about 3 days old, dad's first wife died and created, as you can expect, just a very difficult situation. Then a number of years later, my mother and my dad were married, and then there were three more children to come along.
10 children in the Hubbard family.
Right, 10 children. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. To me, there was never a distinction. It was not that the older seven were my half-brothers and sisters. They were my brothers and sisters.
Yes. Tell us about your mother. What was she like?
Well, my mother and dad were really quite different people. My mother was more, I suppose, the typical daughter of immigrants. Her parents had come from Norway. Her education had been cut short. When she was in fifth grade, her mother had died. She had to leave school and start doing the things at home that had to be done. She worked as a hired girl, and she, in that capacity, she came to work in the Hubbard household. to this day, I marvel that my mother had the whatever to come into a household with seven children,
yes.
Noisy, energetic children, at a time, must have been, what, 1929, when there were very few conveniences in any homes in Presho. She had a tremendous work ethic, a very capable woman.
Yes. You returned to Norway, or you went to Norway to visit not too long ago. Did you feel a connection to your mother?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. A sister and I went, and we stayed with a woman who was actually our mother's half-sister. And we met all of our cousins, and we were there 2 weeks. And during the entire time, this thought kept coming back to me over and over again. If my grandfather, my mother's father, had eventually gone back to Norway, and which was somewhat unusual. He had stayed there and then raised a second family in Norway. And all I could think about was, if this family had just stayed in South Dakota, they would have been my American cousins, not more Norwegian
right.
cousins, and I could have known them.
Right. And your father, he was of English or Scots-Irish origins?
Yes, he was. He was. Came out of a family where education was very highly valued, where there was a tremendous amount of family pride, something my siblings and I heard frequently growing up, be proud, remember you're a Hubbard. And I think that came from his family of origin.
He was a strong personality?
Very strong personality. As I point out in the book, I grew up in a home that was really dominated by my father, not by my mother. And that, not, I don't say that in a negative sense. My father had very many very, very good qualities, but he had a very strong personality.
So you didn't drink coffee, is that correct?
That's right. Englishmen drank tea.
Yes. And what about this no shorts situation?
Oh, well, my father had many views, of course, about proper behavior, and this went from learning proper penmanship. We were schooled in proper grammar, and people were to dress appropriately. And when our friend showed up in shorts, my sister and I would just groan inwardly because we knew we would hear about that. Neither of us feel comfortable wearing shorts today.
Your father worked hard.
He worked very hard. And I suppose if there is, other than the land itself and the harshness of the land, I suppose if there's one theme that just resonates through that entire book, it's hard work, just incredibly hard work.
Why did people work so hard? Why did your father work so hard?
Well, I don't think he could have survived if he hadn't worked hard.
And that connects to the land, to the harshness, the unforgiving character of the West River of South Dakota.
That's right. And also, of course, in the 1920s, this was a time when agriculture in many parts of the country was having a tough time, and then the Depression simply made everything worse. He had many mouths to feed. He was a very proud man, and going on welfare, going, you know, having any kind of assistance, it just wouldn't do. And so I think it was a combination of his own personality, his upbringing, and the environment in which he lived.
Yes. And all the 10 Hubbard children, I'm sure, worked very, very hard.
Very hard.
Including you as a kid.
Yes, yes. Many, many work experiences. Not only, we all had to work for a time in my father's business, he was a farm implement dealer, but all of us had many, many jobs within the town. My brothers worked at Fairmont Food. My sister and I picked chickens at Fairmont Food.
Maybe you better explain that, Dorothy. What does picking chickens mean?
Well, you know, I suppose most people say plucking chickens. In the old days, when the farmers brought the chickens to town, it was a seasonal thing. Maybe there would be 2 weeks of work. People in town would come in and be hired. You would be paid 3 cents per chicken for picking a chicken. It was a room where the chickens were, the internal cavities were cleaned out. The chickens were dunked in hot water, and then everybody hung their chicken on a little hook. And you simply stood there up into deep and, you know, ankle-deep feathers, pulling the feathers off the chicken.
It doesn't sound like very pleasant work, and yet in your description of it in your book, you don't make it sound so terrible.
It wasn't. It was seasonal work. No one had to do that day in and day out.
Yeah.
It gave people a chance to come together and socialize, as strange as that might sound. And I've talked to friends of mine who also did this, and we have a common memory on this of the women especially standing, talking, joking, laughing during the course of the work.
Right. There is in Presque, South Dakota, as in many small towns, a kind of community code of behavior. Can you describe that for us?
There is. And for the most part, I think it's very good. It includes neighborliness. People care about one another. It includes a certain way of thinking. People are to be proud of what they do, but people are not to dwell on themselves. The conversation is never really to stay with you for too long. Boasting is not really a part of this. Somebody else will talk about your accomplishments. And there's something else which has always appealed to me. I call a Midwestern nice. People make an effort to get along with other people.
Right. Are there negative characteristics in this kind of community behavior?
I'm not so sure in the community behavior itself. I think one of the things that I've thought of many times in growing up in a small town, there's no time for reflection, at least where I grew up. There's not much time to talk about ideas or, in a sense, even to think about the future. The present, the present day is here and now. You have to cope with that. You have to work very hard to keep going. And none of us really developed a sense of contemplation until really we left.
Yes.
I make the point in the book that there were no dreamers on the Northern Plains.
Yes. You still go back to Presque sometimes, and you still go to family reunions. Tell us about those family reunions.
Oh, those family reunions. We don't hold them as often as we used to, but family reunions are fun. Everybody remembers so much about when we were all growing up. My brothers especially just have a great sense of humor and a way of telling things that, you know, telling a story that everybody really enjoys. And like everybody's family reunion, the same old stories are trotted out, and everyone still thinks they're just hilarious.
Do you have one you can share with us? Is it possible?
Oh, well, I do. This is my favorite one. I'll try to tell it quickly here. My father did a lot of things during the Depression. And one of the things was to repair windmills. Now, this meant crawling up a ladder to a platform 60 feet high to usually repair the mechanism of the windmill. He always took along one of his sons. One time he had Harold, Brother Harold, 12 years old. Now, Dad usually put ropes around their waists so if they fell off, you know, they wouldn't fall all the way. This time, for whatever reason he forgot, he and Harold are very carefully working their way around the platform. At one point, Dad forgot. He bent over. Harold was behind him. Harold fell off. His feet were still on the platform, and almost unbelievably, he reached out and he caught the tail of the windmill. He's hanging there, trying to work his way back. My father turned around, looked at this, and a common expression that he used, God Almighty Harold, for once in your life, can't you quit fooling around? That was the quintessential character of my father.
Thank you, Dorothy. We've been talking with Dorothy Hubbard Schweder, sharing stories of her family and of growing up in the Midwest of South Dakota. Her book is called Growing Up with the Town, Family and Community on the Great Plains, published by the Iowa University Press. Thank you very much, Dorothy.
Thank you.
Dream by the old canal.
To complement our interview on Small Town America, we thought we would call to your attention an historic site, in this case a virtual historic site, where you can learn more about American folk life and music through the work of John and Ruby Lomax. Here to tell you about it is Kelly Schrum of George Mason University's Center for History and New Media.
Some people say that the weary blues ain't bad.
In 1939, John Lomax, curator of the Archive of American Folk Song, and his wife Ruby Lomax embarked on a journey across the American South. They recorded 25 hours of folk music and stories by more than 300 performers, including ballads.
So tell her, don't make me dream, bridges, Rosemary and Dan.
Blues, canciones, children's songs.
Hold my horse while I jump, Josie. Hold my horse while I jump, Josie. Hold my horse while I jump, Josie. I love Susie Brown.
Field hollers, spirituals.
Oh, my Lord, getting us ready for that great day. Lord, my Lord, getting us ready for that great day.
And work songs. This rich, accessible Library of Congress American Memory website presents in audio 700 of these songs, both instrumental and vocal, accompanied by brief descriptions and histories. Information includes musical features, performers, and place and date of recording. This website also offers photographs, dust jackets, field notes, and letters from the Lomax's trip. This is an excellent site for exploring Southern folk life and music, and more broadly, American folk life and music. Many of these tunes and stories will sound familiar, regardless of where you were born. To locate Southern Mosaic, go to historymatters.gmu.edu and type Southern Mosaic into the keyword search.
For most of us, minstrel shows are a reminder of a period in history we would just as soon forget. For over half a century after their appearance in the 1850s, they helped spread negative stereotypes of African Americans. Well, minstrel shows are back, this time as artistic forms, prompting Sean Marie Garrett to comment on the challenges they pose. Sean Marie Garrett is a professor of theater at Barnard College of Columbia University in New York City.
Minstrel shows are usually associated with the 19th century, but in the past two decades, blackface, minstrelsy, and stereotypes have once again surfaced as cutting-edge artistic forms in the United States. Plays like Uncle Tom's Cabin and Mamba's Daughters have been revived in politically savvy productions with multicultural casts. Forgotten performers like Pigmeat Markham, Stephen Fetchett, and the Venus Hottentot have been resurrected. Uncle Remus, Mammy, and other black stereotypes have emerged as new sources of inspiration for both black and white artists. Among these artists is this year's Pulitzer Prize winner for drama, Susan Laurie Parks, and the visual artist, Carol Walker, both of whom have won MacArthur Genius Awards. Even Spike Lee revived blackface performance in his recent film Bamboozled, which centers on the rise and fall of a fictional hit TV show called Mantan's New Millennium Minstrel Show. And these are only a few examples. Is postmodern minstrelsy the final frontier of shock, or by now the ultimate cliché? Minstrelsy's revival in the 80s and 90s coincided with the killing of unarmed black men by police, racial profiling, and the dismantling of affirmative action, a coincidence that makes the work even more difficult to interpret or defend. Artists working with stereotypes are frequently criticized for underestimating the destructive power of these images. In a sense, these criticisms are right. The best of this work does confront ugliness. It raids history and brings some of its deliberately forgotten scenes to light. It can be painful, offensive, and sometimes, uncomfortably, hilarious. But for all its interest in the past, the best of this work is not politically retrograde. It's just that the artists who create it do not believe that history is behind us, that if we strike the proper attitude, all the ambivalence will somehow go away. This art does not say black is beautiful, stereotypes are cruel, and whites are to blame. Instead, it asks, what is black? What is white? Could one exist without the other? How do we all play racial roles? And what are the consequences of these habits? How do they become hardened into ideologies, cultures, styles, and even behavior? There's a danger when stereotypes come cheap, because history never does. Still, the return of minstrelsy is by now an established strain of contemporary art and performance with its own historical rationale. Artists experimenting with forbidden images are determined to face these demons of their own unconscious. In doing so, they challenge us to face them as well.
You've been listening to Sean Marie Garrett, Professor of Theater at Barnard College of Columbia University in New York City. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. You can learn more about the OAH and Talking History at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
Somebody quicker, sharp as you are, somebody.